This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Kamala Harris tells us she's worried about the root causes of illegal immigration. Although she recently visited Latin America to find out what they are, the vice president didn't examine while there a potentially huge new impetus for that problem and a disaster for the region and our country more generally. One of South America's most important nations is Peru. It may soon be lost to communists who have been working for decades with varying degrees of success to take over, bankrupt, and otherwise destroy states from Mexico to Argentina. Inevitably, when that happens, millions of people flee their homelands. Venezuela is a prime example of this phenomenon at the moment. Anger over COVID and widespread fraud may make an avowed Marxist with ties to Shining Path terrorists Peru's next president. If Pedro Castillo wins, our hemisphere will lose big time. This is Frank Gaffney.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman whose intelligence we admire greatly and have had the privilege of taking advantage of from time to time is our great friend and colleague, Carolyn Glick. She is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, a driving force behind LATMA, an outstanding television production in Israel, where she now resides. She has in the past served as an aide to then Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and we wanted to take stock with her today. After he has been removed from office, rather unceremoniously, I might say, to talk about what that means for Israel, what it means for the United States, whether it's likely to be permanent, and more. These are the questions, I think, on the minds of all of us who are deeply committed to the state of Israel and its security. And few people understand all these issues better than Carolyn Glick. So it's a delight to welcome her back. Thank you for joining us. Good to talk with you, my dear.
Great to be on your show, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So how is it that Benjamin Netanyahu, after 12 years of really, I think, an extraordinary run as Prime Minister of the State of Israel, has now been removed by people who seem to be wholly inadequate to replace him?
This is sort of a very dirty parliamentary trick that took place. I mean, Israel, I think, as you know, and perhaps your listeners know, we have a parliamentary democracy. It has lots of parties in it. And traditionally, it's been divided along the right-left continuum. And each of the sides of the continuum, the right and the left, have one major party, generally speaking. And then after elections, see which block is going to be able to put together a governing coalition, the right-wing block or left-wing block, whoever's able to put together 61 seats for a governing majority in the 120-seat Knesset. When nobody can do that, then generally we've had what's called a unity government, which is when the head of the biggest party on the right and the head of the biggest party on the left get together and they form a ruling coalition together because they can't they can't hang separately, so they hang together. But what we have here is something different, which is that the right wing in the last elections, which were held in March, won a 65-seat majority, which should have enabled Netanyahu to form a stable governing coalition in the 120-seat Knesset. But instead, what happened was that two very minor parties, Naftali Bennett's Yamina Party, which literally means to the right, as in to the right of Likud, and a party called New Hope, which was formed by a disgruntled former Likud minister named Gideon Saar, refused to join a coalition under his leadership. And Naftali did it in sort of a sneaky way, and Gideon did it openly. He said he would not serve under Netanyahu. So they instead took their two minor parties, bolted their ideological bloc, and join the left. They call it a unity government, but actually it isn't, because it's keeping out the bulk of the right-wing bloc. And it's just these two little parties, each with six seats, going and joining a coalition, 75% of which is comprised of center-left and radical-left parties. And the last 5% is controlled by an Islamist party, actually, that's aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood. So they have a 20% share of their government, and it's dominated by the left and the radical left. And in a way, it's controlled by the Islamists because it's a tiny, it's just a 61-seat government. So any defection brings it down. And as a result, it's sort of hostage to the four person Islamist bloc, Islamist party that can bring it down at any time if they aren't beholden to its demands.
So what you're describing is at best an unstable government, and at worst one that is absolutely antithetical to what the majority of Israeli voters thought they were going to put into power. How is this being received by Israel? And obviously, there's a substantial number of people who hate Bibi and wanted to bring him down. But those aside, the never Bibi crowd, I guess we would call them, how is this playing out in Israel at the moment?
So one thing that you have to understand about the instability or stability of this coalition is that Naftali Bennett and Gideon Saar have just thrown their voters over a cliff, right? Because by joining this very radical government, they've burned their bridges to their base. And since they're only minor parties, their voters will not have a difficult time finding alternatives on the right that are more credible. So they don't have any political future. Right, but they don't have a political future. That's the thing. And one of the Likud members called them suicide bombers, which was a little bit over the top. But the basic idea was that they don't have anywhere to go back. This is a, this was a one-way trip to the left because they can't come back. So that means that they're beholden completely to the left. So that's about that. How is it being run in Israel? The media in Israel is very much like the media in the United States. They have been dedicated to annihilating Netanyahu in the public mind and in any other way possible, really, for the past 20 years. And so the media is, as is its wont, providing extremely distorted portrait of what just happened to the public. I mean, there are other alternatives. Media organs, like the largest circulation in paper in Israel, Israel Hayom, which I'm a senior columnist for, and other outlets. But the electronic media, the radio and television are overwhelmingly left wing. And so they're celebrating this. They were basically on the streets. And we had, just to give you a sense of how radical they are, President Trump was the entire population of Israel recognized that he was the most pro-Israel president in history. And one of the television stations here has a correspondent in Washington, and he was on the streets of Washington dancing with Democrats in his report after Biden was inaugurated. So you know, that just sort of gives you a sense of just how open they are. Yeah, just how open they are in their bias.
Right. And this is endemic in Israel. I think it's fair to say that your press makes our press look conservative in terms of how
well,
far to the left they are.
You have more balance because you have Fox and you have Newsmax and you have other outlets. We just have one small right-wing television station, which is actually an improvement because we didn't have that even a couple of years ago, but they have a tiny budget and they're not capable of doing anything significant.
So what are the implications of this period? Bibi has made very clear his parting statement in the Knesset was very powerful, obviously quite bitter toward Naftali Bennett, by whom his party's voters were betrayed. But he warned of very dire implications if this government lasts at all. First of all, do you anticipate it will last very long? And if it does, give us a sense of how you see those implications.
I really don't know how long it'll last because, I mean, I think it'll last as long as what's called the alternate prime minister, who's really just the prime minister, Lapid. Yair Lapid is the head of the largest left-wing party, and he's the foreign minister now, and they have a rotation agreement, he and Naftali. And so he's supposed to take over in 2 years, in 2023. And I think that really this government will last as long as he wants it to last because they want to pass laws that bar Netanyahu from running for Knesset. And they need to pass those laws, particularly Lapid, because so long as Netanyahu is the head of the nationalist bloc in Israel, no left-wing candidate has a chance of winning a governing majority because Netanyahu remains the most popular leader in Israel and the most powerful political force in Israel. And so their greatest goal on the left is to remove him not only from office as they did yesterday, but remove him from politics, remove the threat of Netanyahu because he's in the Knesset leading the opposition. They'll never be able to win an election outright. They can only steal through parliamentary tricks like they did yesterday. And so, you know, that's now on the table in the Knesset is a bill that would specifically, personally bar Netanyahu, only Netanyahu, from running again for Knesset, which is, you know, it doesn't pass any test of a rule of law democracy, but they don't care.
But how does that work?
They can fall tomorrow.
Does that mean
if they have a parliamentary majority for this, if they can get 61 votes in favor of it, then it'll be a law.
So he would be removed from the Knesset altogether, or does he have to
be
barred from running again?
Right. He would be barred from running again.
But so for the interim, he could remain the opposition leader and presumably, as he promised he would do, he can work to try to bring down the government. But it does presumably get trickier if he is barred from power altogether and the chance to return to power, I should say. So this, again, gives rise, Carolyn Glick, to a question about this comes at a dangerous time. I did a commentary yesterday on the subject. A lot of evil enemies of Israel are on the march at the moment. I think it's fair to say, in part encouraged to be so, by the Biden-Harris administration. Where does this leave Israel at the moment, as you see it, and what's the way ahead?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest dangers emanating from this government, and Netanyahu alluded to it, is the incompetence of its leaders. I mean, Bennett has no major achievements under his belt, aside from taking a couple of high-tech companies public and making a lot of money. And Lapid was one of the worst finance ministers we've ever had during his brief stint as finance minister in one of Netanyahu's governments together with Bennett in 2013. He was a failed finance minister, and before that, he was a television entertainer. So they're incompetent, really, to handle the threats that Israel faces, just based on their records, but also based on their lack of judgment. And so what we're already seeing now, we saw in the last couple of weeks when it started becoming clear that they were going to go ahead and do this, and that Netanyahu is about to be ousted from power, is that they're aligning Israel's strategic policy with that of the Biden administration on key issues, on two key issues that pose both of them in their own way an existential threat to Israel. That is, they threaten Israel's very existence. The first one is on Iran's nuclear program, and the second one is on the issue of the Palestinian conflict with Israel. And the Biden administration supports enabling Iran to become a nuclear power. I mean, that's essentially the end point of the nuclear deal that they're seeking to reinstate. And the Biden administration supports the establishment of a Palestinian state in areas that Israel requires to protect itself and to maintain its very existence as a Jewish state. And you have a majority in this government that supports Biden's policies on the Palestinians and on Iran.
Which presumably will translate into further emboldening both the Iranians and the Palestinians. We've seen the effects of that most recently in vicious attacks against Israel, some 4,000 rockets and missiles and so on coming out of Gaza. You've also talked with us in the past, Carolyn, about the sort of terrorist attacks by Israeli Arabs, not just these Palestinians. When this is translated into action by such entities, whether it's Iran itself, whether it's its proxies like Hamas or Hezbollah, for that matter, or these Israeli Arabs, I should say, it seems as though we're going to see some very rough sledding for Israel. Might this become the catalyst for a new conflict between Israel and its Arab Muslim adversaries? And if so, how would you characterize Israel's position to contend with such an eventuality, given the character of this particular government?
You know, nothing invites aggression better than weakness. And this government, because of, you know, the radical nature of most of its members and the sort of confusion and weakness of its leadership, that's precisely the message that it's sending out. So yeah, I think that they're inviting aggression against Israel. And regarding what Israel would do in a situation like that, I mean, it's important to know that Netanyahu, as opposition leader, isn't going to be harming, you know, trying to undermine Israel's war efforts. In 2006, he was opposition leader during the Second Lebanon War, which was led incompetently by Ehud Olmert. But Netanyahu immediately rallied to the side of the government and worked tirelessly to defend Israel in the international arena, and was constantly speaking with Olmert and trying to give him advice to protect the country. So I don't think that there would be anything different about the way that he would respond to a national emergency under this government. And so I think that in that sense, they would have the benefit of his experience, but only if they want it. Because one of the worst aspects of this government is that the real reason that it was formed to begin with was because Gideon Saar and Naftali Bennett and the members of their factions, their little tiny factions, share one very important position with the radical left and the moderate left and the Islamist. And that is a burning, all-consuming, obsessive hatred and envy of Netanyahu. And so I don't know whether they would be willing to accept support from him. And I think that that's really a danger. I don't doubt the capacity of Israel's armed forces to defend the country, but I do doubt the capacity of Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, the defense minister, to adequately lead this country in times of national emergency. And I think that really is a big problem.
It is a huge problem. And to just make matters worse, if you back the lens up, Israel is not simply confronting challenges from Iran or even the Palestinians, as you know better than just about anybody, Carolyn Glick, whether it's Syria or Lebanon or Turkey or Libya, all of these places, the Russian involvement, the Chinese perhaps in the mix now with Iran especially. I mean, these are the kinds of dynamics that almost certainly are going to end badly. And therefore, Israel's ability to deter, and if deterrence fails, to contend effectively with such a multifaceted threat environment is just absolutely of paramount importance, obviously, to the Jewish state itself, but I would argue also to the United States of America. And hence, I guess the question then recurs, is there a chance, as Bibi has promised, that he will be able to return to power sooner rather than later? And if so, how does that come about?
Well, he had his first meeting as opposition leader today, and I think he said something very important. He said it requires iron discipline from the opposition to bring them down, but there already is. I mean, the one thing that he has with the 52 members of his opposition faction is a single-minded determination to oust this government. And they also are very cohesive in terms of their governing policies and the policies that they're going to advance as the opposition. So this is going to be an incredibly powerful opposition. And you also, again, you have these two suicide parties, right? They have six members, and each of them. And the members of those parties, are any of them who want to have a future in politics, are going to be thinking every minute of every day whether they should stay where they are or run away. And so I think, you know, you may see an ineluctable and ever-increasing pressure on members of Bennett's faction and Saar's faction to leave their parties and join Likud. And to that end, by the way, Netanyahu already received the permission of the Likud Central Committee to bring in three defectors from the coalition into Likud and to give them guaranteed positions on the Likud list for the next election, so that he will be able with that to bring about to keep massive pressure on the two right-wing factions in the government to break apart. And if they do that, then this government falls.
From your lips to God's ears, as they say. Carolyn Glick, thank you for helping explicate what is going on in a country that I believe is vital to America's security interests in that region, as well as to so many millions of Americans who, for a variety of reasons, attach great importance to our strategic partnership with Israel. And we appreciate all that you do to help illuminate what the stakes are and why that faith in and commitment to Israel is warranted. Thanks for what you do at Israel Hayom, as well as your two terrific books, The Israeli Solution, A One-State Plan for Peace in the Middle East, and Shackled Warrior, and for joining us from time to time.
Frank, just also, your listeners can watch my weekly webcast, the Carolyn Glick Middle East News Hour, from my website, carolynglick.com, or subscribe to my channels on Rumble or YouTube to watch them every week for more in-depth analysis of what's happening.
Fantastic. If you've liked what you heard today, there's a lot more of it where that came from. Thank you, Carolyn. Join us again soon if you would. God bless you and your people. Talk to you soon. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I am really ecstatic to say we're joined by a man I've come to admire enormously for his acumen about a subject that I think all of us need to know a lot more about, and that is cybersecurity. And it turns out that Joe Weiss, who is a professional engineer with a number of credentials in risk and information security management, a distinguished track record in industry, and he is these days associated with Applied Control Solutions, LLC. I've had the privilege of getting to know Joe a little bit through his collaboration with one of the most important efforts that our Center for Security Policy has been involved in, I think, for, 12 or so more years, called the Secure the Grid Coalition. And you can find out more about it at securethegrid.com. Joe participates in weekly calls, just about all of them, and inevitably brings insights to bear about what has been learned, what is afoot, what we should be alive to in terms of the threats, particularly coming from the cyber space vector. But I've asked him to join us today because it turns out he also knows a lot about nuclear power. And we've had reports in the press about a potential problem. We're still sorting out the magnitude of it, and this is an unfolding story. Since it involves communist China, you can be sure we may never know the full extent of the problem, but the French are involved in it too, and so we may have a better fix on it as a result of their participation. But I'm anxious to talk with Joe Weiss about this Tishan plant in Guangdong province in China. And to then explore with him a little bit about what we've been learning lately about cybersecurity as well. Joe, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you for the invitation.
The pleasure is mine.
And I, by the way, I appreciate being able to be part of that Friday call because I also get information coming my way. It's been two-way and it's been really good.
Good. Well, I commend particularly my colleague, Tommy Waller, who has done a remarkable job of managing that effort, the Secure the Grid Coalition and those calls. So we appreciate him and you. Let's get right to it. Joe, what do we know at this moment about what's gone on at this plant? It's just one of some 47 of these nuclear plants around China. But this involves a relatively new nuclear power plant technology called EPR. What does that stand for and what's the significance of it?
Okay, the EPR stands for the Evolutionary Pressurized Water Reactor. It is basically a French next-generation design of the pressurized water reactor that Westinghouse originally developed here in the States. And the French, basically, and the Germans had developed that. That's, in a sense, I guess you could call it the third generation reactor. And the EPR is a very large reactor. So the two reactors we're talking about in China, as best as I can tell, they're the largest in terms of generation, you know, capacity in the world. These are two very, very large nuclear plants, Unit 1 and Unit 2. And the problem apparently has occurred at Unit 1. What we are told, and, you know, this started off by a an article from in CNN. And according to CNN, it states, and I'm going to basically just read from their report, the U.S. government has spent the past week assessing a report of a leak at a Chinese nuclear power plant after a French company that part owns and helps operate it warned of an imminent radiological threat, according to U.S. officials and documents reviewed by CNN. The warning included an accusation that the Chinese safety authority was raising the acceptable limits for radiation detection outside the Taishan nuclear plant in Guangdong province in order to avoid having to shut it down, according to a letter from the French company to the U.S. Department of Energy obtained by CNN.
So they're releasing, presumably, radioactive gases. Is that the point? And they want nobody to raise too much of a ruckus about it because they don't want to shut down the plant. Why would they be so keen not to shut the plant down, Joe?
Well, obviously, when you shut a plant down, it costs a lot of money. Years ago, we calculated it's like a 1,000-megawatt nuclear plant, and this is something like 1,700. But years ago, it was like $500,000 a day replacement power cost. Today, it may be closer to $1 million a day for a plant that size. I'm saying of 1,000 megawatt, this is 1,700. So it's huge.
Yeah, so, but Joe, here's the thing.
In a funny way, think of the Colonial Pipeline shutdown. how much that cost when it was
down. The ripple effects. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you really don't want to ever shut these down if you can afford.
The concern, though, of course, is that you have to balance that cost against the possibility of large contamination of the population downwind from the plant. This was, of course, a big concern with our own nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. The Chinese have not distinguished themselves, I think it's generous to say, in terms of their concern about their population. So might this help explain why they would be inclined to just sort of brazen it out rather than take a step that would actually have some cost in terms of the rest of the power supply?
That's a good possibility. The other possibility is the Chinese are marketing this plant all over the world. So the last thing they want to do is in any way, shape, or form have any question as to its reliability or safety, because this is Unit 1, which is the one we're talking about, is the first EPR to go commercial.
And Joe, in that CNN report, as I recall, there was some speculation that these gases might not be being released by the Chinese, but rather they're leaking. The suggestion being that there might be a crack, one or more, in the containment vessel itself, which would be a substantially larger problem, presumably. Do you have any insight into what the likelihood of that is?
Don't know. But what I do know is this, that, you know, what was described in the report is you have these radiation monitors that are monitoring the piping in the plant. The same way you would monitor, again, I'll go back to the Colonial Pipeline. You monitor the pipe with leak detection. You know, you're looking for tiny leaks as indication that a pipe is cracking. Well, in a nuclear plant, you're monitoring not only, if you will, steam or water, you know, in terms of it leaking, but if there is any type of radiation there, you're also monitoring the radiation. You know, it's an indication if there is a leak. So this is a very important safety issue that you don't walk away from.
And this is why, presumably, the French have been raising the alarm, among others, with our government. Apparently, the Biden administration is not persuaded that it is a crisis at this point. Would you counsel differently?
Well, the first thing is, you're talking about Framatome being the French part owner and constructor. Framatome commercially offers all of these nuclear plant services. They also sell plants, et cetera, et cetera. For them to have to reach out, there is something very different or wrong here. This is what they do for a living.
And they would have an interest, just as the Chinese do, to not signal that there's anything wrong with one of their products. Joe, we could go on. I think it's safe to say that this is a story we're going to be hearing a lot more about probably in the days ahead. And I would like to get you to come back with updates, if you would, based again on your expertise with this plant design and particularly working through the safety issues associated with it. But I did, before I let you go, want to ask you some questions about cyber.
Okay, before you do that, I'm going to give you a connection from where we were talking about the nuclear plant to the discussions you want to have on cybersecurity.
A segue, we call it in the business.
A perfect segue. And that is, I was actually involved in analyzing this particular plant design for cybersecurity. And the original design for the EPR, and I can't speak for what China has done, but I can speak for what others did, is it turns out the initial design was using all digital equipment. And it turned out, from a cybersecurity perspective, it wasn't safe.
This is a point that is something that I have learned and found somewhat incredible, truthfully, that the old analog, as they call them, switches, are a lot more robust than these highfalutin fancy new digital control devices. And you've been one of the most important mentors on this subject, Joe. And it brings me to the second topic. And thank you for that nice segue. We've had of late a number of these so-called ransomware attacks that have taken out, you mentioned Colonial Pipeline's infrastructure in the East Coast of the United States for a time. We've had food production plants taken offline. We've had healthcare industries. We've even had the ferry that goes out to Martha's Vineyard, perhaps inconveniencing some of our elite who have the privilege of vacationing out there. But these others have affected an awful lot of others of us, and the potential for tremendous harm has been underscored. Talk a little bit about what the takeaways are, as you see it, from these experiences, and more generally, how urgent it is that we start really getting serious about the kinds of things you've been devoting your life to, namely cybersecurity.
Okay, again, thank you for the question. And here, I want to separate it into two pieces. The first is the IT security, which is your business networks. That's what ransomware goes after. That's what happened with the Colonial Pipeline, with the meat company, with Scripps Healthcare, with MTA. It's a short-term, non-safety effect. Basically, they're going to lock up your data and they won't give it to you, or they'll make it public if you don't pay the money, you know, and then supposedly you get a decryption key. That's only half of our problem, but it's not the real problem. What I worry about is, like with the Chinese nuclear plant, the sensors, actuators, and drives, in other words, the actual control systems, the devices, have no cybersecurity, no cyber logging, or no authentication to this day.
This is insane.
And when you get to them, that's where you can blow up a pipeline, or you can cause the problems you're talking about in China, or you can bring the grid down for 9 to 18 months. This isn't somebody saying the sky is falling. This is all real and demonstrated. What's bothersome for me is the focus on all of this is at the ransomware level, because people understand it, they've been bitten, but that's not the real concern. The concern is that with like a liquefied natural gas plant sitting like in, you know, Boston Harbor, if the pressure goes up too much and the sensors don't do their job, you could take out a goodly part of Boston.
Yeah, the LNG stuff is very alarming.
And so, Joe, not ransomware.
Yeah, no, this is basically big league cyber warfare and used for highly destructive purposes, not simply shaking people down for money. And Joe, I guess the question that I would just ask of you, and we talk about it a lot on these Secure the Grid calls, is if the grid of the United States, especially over large areas of the United States, were to go down for 9 to 18 months, as you posit could happen as a result of one of these cyber attacks, or by the way, you know, an electromagnetic pulse attack, or perhaps a very well-planned physical sabotage attack for that matter, what would the world look like, or at least what would this country look like after that period collapsed, the pre-industrial age?
Without being flippant, if you have, you know, there was a book, The One Second After, you know, what happens immediately after an EMP? And part of what they were talking about is what's going to be still running. 1950s and 60s cars that have no electronics in them. You know, everything with electronics fried. So, you know, it's a really, really different, you know, it's kind of an ultimate weapon.
And Joe, knowing a lot about security and risk-related issues, is there any question in your mind that adversaries of this country, and I'm not talking about the obvious ones, the Russias and the Chinas, but even the Irans and the North Koreas, and perhaps, you know, jihadist groups for that matter, are aware of our vulnerabilities and have doctrines to exploit them?
As an engineer, I don't try to go into, if you will, threat assessments. What I can tell you is, from firsthand, the Russians know about the lack of security in these devices. They actually did a demonstration at when I was still running my ICS cybersecurity conference back in 2016. China is well aware of this. Iran is aware of this. I was at an International Atomic Energy Agency conference in Vienna when the vice president of security for Korea Hydro and Nuclear gave a presentation of how the North Koreans were going after the South Korean nuclear plants. This is not, there's nothing hypothetical here.
This is the real world. And so, Joe, the final question is, and honestly, it's vexed me beyond words, and I think it has you too, having heard you talk about these issues, is if this is all not conjecture or hypothetical or a possible, you know, projection, but the real world, how on earth is it that we have not taken steps since at least, you know, you worked on this in 2016, for example, or further back than that, I know. What's the impediment to making, well, for just one example, control systems throughout our grid secure against cyber attack?
In many cases, it's ourselves, our own industry. What I'm hoping is that the credit rating agencies and the insurance companies will simply say the risk is too great. You either do the right thing or we won't, you know, we won't insure you or we'll hit your credit rating.
Yes, that is a sensational idea. Again, people, you know, I think the ordinary layperson listening to this would say, well, don't the people who run these utilities, don't the industries in question have loved ones who will be imperiled? I mean, because the projection is that, you know, 9 out of 10 of us would perish if we go back to the 1850s style economy and, you know, and agricultural dependencies and so on. And how do you respond to that, sir?
All I can say is, I'll give you a concrete example. In March 2007, the Idaho National Lab did the Aurora hardware demonstration, made its way to CNN, where they showed how they could, just using bits and bytes from a PC, blow up a 27-ton diesel generator. Okay? Just using bits and bytes. It's as if they would have stuck sticks of dynamite under it. And yet, here we are in 2021. And the utilities have still not addressed the Aurora vulnerability.
It's unbelievable.
This was in 2007.
Well, Joe Weiss, I know that it's not for want of your trying to get them to take corrective action. I commend you for that work. I appreciate specifically the degree to which you have helped others of us who are concerned about this vulnerability of ours to understand it better. And I think in particular, if you'll come back to us with updates on this topic, as well as the Chinese nuclear plant that seems to be in trouble, I would be profoundly grateful, and I'm sure our audience will be as well. Thank you for all you do for our country, Joe Weiss, and I know you're going to keep it up because that's what you do, and I look forward to our next visit, hopefully in the very near future. In the meantime, again, thanks for joining us today at Secure Freedom Radio. That's it for today's program. We appreciate very much your joining us. I hope you'll do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same place.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. President Biden will address a joint session of some of Congress tonight. As a public service, here's a translation into plain English of what he's likely to say. President will gloat about the booming U.S. economy. Translation: unchecked government spending is creating a sugar high that actually imperils the dollar as the world's reserve currency and therefore America's economic viability. The president will tout Senate Democrats' S-1 bill as vital to election integrity. Translation: this legislation would guarantee voting fraud and preclude future free and fair balloting. And President Biden will claim to have restored America's world leadership. Translation: international contempt for him and his team is evident in growing threats from China, Russia, and Iran. Glib presidential talk about unity and progress must not mislead us about the dangerous fundamental transformation of America now underway and the imperative need to resist it. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Dan Perkins with your Songs and Stories for Soldiers, Veterans, Tip of the Day. In this period of sequester of millions of Americans, including veterans, healthcare is even more important. The Department of Veterans Affairs Video Connect mobile application enables you to connect with the virtual medical room. In the virtual medical room, you can participate in a video healthcare visit. A hands-on physician examination is not required. You access your provider on a scheduled date and time, just like a face-to-face visit at the clinic examining room. So here's your veterans tip of the day. Get enrolled in the VA healthcare system. Have an email account where the link to the virtual medical room can be sent. For more information about this important service, go to va.gov, search for VA Video Connect Service. Quality healthcare is just a click away. This has been your Songs and Stories for Soldiers, Veterans Tip of the Day.
Dan Perkins here with your Songs and Stories for Soldiers, Veterans Tip of the Day. There is a growing concern among service members and their families about various blood, prostate, and urinary tract cancers. Navy Commander Mike Crosby, founder of Veterans Prostate Awareness, said, "We don't know what the cause is. That study has yet to be done." So here's your Veterans Tip of the Day. Go to vetsprostate.org. That's vetsprostate.org and check it out. Remember, an early diagnosis increases the survival rate. This has been your Songs and Stories, Veterans Tip of the Day.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The legend of Robin Hood speaks of Richard the Lionhearted. Upon his return to England after crusading in the Holy Land, he took back the throne from his brother John. After his death, though, John again ruled oppressively. The angry barons responded by capturing London and on this date, June 15, 1215, surrounded John on the plains of Runnymede. There, the arbitrary power of the king was forever limited when they forced him to sign the Magna Carta. It ends with these words.